Welcome to another episode of the Your Brain Uncovered podcast, where it is my job to interview pioneering scientists and authors to tease out some of their most fascinating work. We discuss neuroscience and psychology tools for everyday living. I'm Aya Tarabin. I'm a translational neuroscience student and a researcher at University College London. Also want to emphasize that this podcast is my personal goal of bringing zero cost to consumer information to the public. It is separate from my other roles. Now, have you ever wondered why is it that you remember the name of your childhood best friend, yet you struggle so hard to recall the name of a person you met just 5 minutes ago? I mean, they're both names after all. You know, there's something about memory that makes some aspects of it stick around, while others not so much, right? Now, what's the reason behind this? In this episode, we're going to be joined by Dr. Christopher Naden. Dr. Christopher is an associate professor in the School of Psychology at the University of Nottingham, and he's joining us today to help us better understand the factors that make some experiences and some aspects of memory more memorable than others. Those include, you know, motivation, and some existing semantic knowledge. So yeah, and we're gonna look at how exactly these factors can influence and manifest themselves in our future decisions.
Thank you. Dr. Christopher, welcome to the show. It's an honor to have you here.
Thank you.
I believe the question begs itself. How would you best define what emotional memory is?
So emotional memory is, I guess, a specific type of stuff that's kind of important to us.
Okay.
So let's say, for instance, evolutionarily, if something is like when there is, let's say, a fearful response or even a positive response, then it'd be good to remember what kind of led to those outcomes so that we can avoid bad things and make good things happen more often. So we kind of predicted or had some sort of causal relationship with an emotional response should be more memorable. So that's some of my work is on emotional memory, but kind of more broadly, some of it's kind of just on what makes some information more memorable than others. So emotion is one of those. Another thing is reward. Another thing that you kind of mentioned in the introduction is if something's more relevant to you, so the name of a close friend or someone that you know well, relative to someone that arguably maybe you've known for as long, but in, let's say more casual, like just someone at work, an acquaintance. So we're trying to maybe separate out just how well you know them from how relevant are they to you, because at least in the real world, a lot of these things can co-vary, and then you tend to know someone relevant to you a lot better. But experimentally, we can kind of try and control for those and focus on things that are kind of, again, more relevant than being more memorable. Mm-hmm. But there's also plenty of other settings where you just have to remember stuff because you're supposed to, in a more kind of textbook learning kind of case. And then a whole other topic of study within memory is memory strategies, where you try and take information that is in some sense relatively more mundane and uninteresting and learn to remember it anyway because you have to and you're going to be tested on it. So both of those kind of are dominant kind of approaches within the literature.
Yeah.
What makes some things just inherently more memorable, and what makes things like, how can we learn things that maybe we don't want to in some sense, but we know we're supposed to.
Well, does this the popular saying of practice makes perfect, does that hold any answers to the question? I mean, there has been some work done at the California Institute of Technology, and it was looking at memory patterns in mice, and it was showing how kind of longer lasting memories were formed by neurons that fire in synchrony. So is it that does that make sense?
So I guess there's a few different things came to mind just from that kind of brief question there.
Yeah.
So one is there's different kinds of memory.
Yeah.
There's lots of ways to categorize it.
All right.
The one that came to mind based on how you asked that is the idea of something called episodic memory and something else called semantic memory.
Mm-hmm.
So episodic memory is more of memory for events and kind of specific instances in the past.
Okay.
Whereas semantic memory is more facts to some degree about the world, but also could be about you. But things that are more just, they're true because they are and somewhat get associated with the events where they were learned.
All right.
So, for instance, if I ask you what's the alphabet, hopefully you'd know.
Hopefully.
But also, like, if I ask you, like, what are some parts of the brain in kind of a brain anatomy sense, that's a much more specialized topic. But for each of those, you probably can't think of exact specific events where you learned it. At some point, Like, yes, you were in classes and these are things that came up, but they kind of transformed into just facts you know.
Of course.
And with that, kind of getting a more reliable pattern of activity and kind of more consistent then, that's more part of how something can transition from being an episodic memory into being semantic. Where through retrieving it multiple times and also things, studying it multiple times, it becomes more of just, this is the core information and stuff about where you were and who were talking at the time and maybe like what book you read it in, that stuff kind of falls away. Those nuances and details that are part of episodic memory become less relevant, and maybe also because they're in different settings. Like, for instance, with learning neuroanatomy, probably learned that, like, in a sense, from multiple sources. Different people taught you things, you saw stuff in books and later read things in papers, and all of that kind of, it's mixed together in terms of what you know about a given kind of word, kind of that as a terminology.
Yeah.
And it just is a mishmash of all of these together. And where you heard what, like, that source information of where it came up maybe gets a little bit lost, and that's kind of refined into semantic memory. Oh. And I guess going to the earlier part of the question about, in a sense, practice and enhancing memory through that, one kind of well-established memory strategy is called retrieval practice.
Yeah.
And there the idea is, to some degree, at least, instead of reading something over and over again, which students tend to do a little bit more than they should, it'd be a better strategy is, let's say, given the same amount of time, like you're not spending more time studying per se, try and practice retrieving information from memory. So this works well if it's not just kind of abstract facts, but like, what's the definition for a term? Or anyway, some things that are more associated and linked. So we can give one thing as a cue and say, okay, tell me more about this. It could be a word, it could be a picture, it could be whatever, but thing you're trying to study from. And then practice retrieving from your memory makes it easier that they'll be able to retrieve from your memory later. And one day I feel like that, at least phrased that way, I feel like it's a bit obvious. Like the more you retrieve something from the memory, the easier it is to do that in the future. But that's effectively the basis of retrieval practice and is one of the best and kind of general purpose and relatively easy, at least in terms of implementation, like flashcards, any sort of kind of way of testing your memory, like fill in the blank kind of thing, works well with this. Like, obviously you need to study some in the first place, but it's much more effective than spending the same time just reading it over and over again.
And, well, obviously, we have a lot of skills up our sleeve to help us, you know, make a memory stick around. And something that seems quite relevant, especially when it comes to emotional memory, is having something that fits along with other things to remember. So association, is it?
Yes. All so associations can make things, I guess, associated with something emotional can make it better.
Yeah.
But also, it's a little bit more complicated with that, because emotion tends to make you remember central things really well and remember kind of contextual or peripheral information worse than if it was compared to something where the central thing was neutral.
Yeah.
So there's more of a bias in that you remember the emotional stuff really well, but something that's kind of in the context and related to it needs to be related enough that's kind of to get those benefits, because otherwise you'll remember them even worse than if you didn't try linking emotion. So it'd be a little bit tricky, and some of the work that I've done has been specifically looking at how emotion can impair memory for associations and kind of the boundaries of that. So for instance, this impairment is more happening with negative emotion, whereas positive emotion tends to help you broaden your attention and link things better. So the valence, the positive or negative kind of attributes of emotion is relevant. But then also, how closely things are bound together in the first place to being sensibly related and not just kind of adding emotion for the sake of it, you'll probably remember the emotional thing, but maybe not the intended to be remembered stuff to go that you're hoping to.
All right. And regarding both types, I mean, positive and negative emotions, which brain structures are generally associated with emotional memory to begin with?
So the main thing ends up being the amygdala. In the literature, there's been a lot more focus on negative and kind of fear responses with the amygdala, but it is involved in positive emotion as well. And I guess one thing that's a little kind of an issue in the field is that there's just generally been more of a focus on negative emotion because it's more reliable across people. So it's easy to show a unpleasant picture and get people find it unpleasant, versus if you're trying to elicit something more positive, there's to some degree a little bit more individual variability,
obviously,
which, and also just it's a bit weaker of effects until you start going to other domains. So I guess with emotion, that if you go into positive, then one thing is somewhat dissociating emotion from reward, mm-hmm. and then let's say striatal activity, which is related as a thing too. But like if I give someone a present when like kind of like you earn points or something good happens along with something that we're trying to get you to remember, is it emotion or is it reward? Or even in other contexts, then like in terms of having a strong positive emotional stimuli,
yeah.
do you show them an erotic image or like what are you doing? And then is that maybe a bit different than just positive otherwise?
Okay.
So like some of my work has been looking at somewhat separating emotional arousal from tabooness. Like if something's a taboo kind of word or topic,
mm-hmm.
they can be positive, they can be negative, but also that's a little bit different than just being high in emotionality. And then mm-hmm. that also ends up being an issue of like, what kind of stimuli do you use? Do you show words? Do you show pictures? Pictures can give you a lot more vivid of a memory than a word can, but then they're also different in like, if you were to put a label on it, we can give you lots of different pictures that all get called spider and are all not enjoyable to look at. But then memory precision of like, which one are you thinking of? Is it the right one? Is a whole other factor then as well.
Interesting. So what that means really is that context and prediction play critical roles in shaping your memory?
Yes, yes, definitely.
All right. So like the most memorable experiences are those that arise from maybe familiar and more stable contexts, yet in some sort of way, if your work seems to hint that they need to kind of violate some aspect of what we predict would occur in that context. So there's like a twist to it, and that's what makes it memorable?
Yes. So a whole other construct in some sense that affects memory and is related to all of that then is how distinct is something?
All right.
Emotional things, at least highly emotional things, don't happen to us on a daily basis.
Mm-mm.
But when we're doing an experimental study, you probably have half of the things that you show are emotional, half the things are neutral.
Yeah.
So then we're violating it there. Like this is more emotional stuff being presented in a short period than normal.
Mm.
But then some of them, at least in terms of trying to do experimental research, we might want to separate, is it the emotional kind of aspect relative to some just things that you don't see often?
Yeah.
So we could also, for instance, show things that are kind of bizarre and odd, but non-emotional as a kind of comparison condition to see, is it emotion or is it just this, let's say, kind of violation of expectations? And like emotion is beneficial, but again, there's a lot of things that are kind of intertwined.
I mean, looking at your work and the existing literature, it seems that there are two kind of alternative neural mechanisms. So there are two ways of looking at the neural processes that underlie emotional memory. So there's the disruption approach, right? So there's like a disruption hypothesis. Is that the one you're coming from?
Yeah. So that, I guess, that wasn't the intention per se, but that is kind of what I found is more mm-hmm. on the side of, emotion disrupting learning of other things.
Yeah.
But again, even in some similar kind of design studies, I have found an enhancement as well.
Mm.
If it ends up being that the thing you're trying to associate is kind of related enough to the emotional thing itself. So like one theory that was proposed some years ago by Mary Mather called the object-based framework ends up kind of suggesting basically like the central thing is emotional, at least that's kind of the basis that we're starting from. And then the thing we're trying to remember along with it, if that ends up being part of overall the same object, it gets enhanced.
Yeah.
If it's more of another object and kind of competing for attention, then it'll end up being relatively disrupted in how well it's remembered because it's kind of more of an either or rather than one kind of holistic unit that's kind of beneficially more globally.
Okay, that's quite interesting. And I'm quite curious to know that do you believe that there's maybe an evolutionary advantage for having an emotional memory, in a sense?
Yes. So starting from what I said earlier, like if you're in a forest and like encounter a tiger and manage to get away, you want to remember stuff about where you were, what time of day, kind of context, like any other kind of information about that incident to hopefully avoid that in the future. Like other bad things might happen, but you don't want to reproduce or like put yourself in peril again.
Yeah.
So these negative things you'd want to avoid in the future, positive things like, I guess, let's say maybe finding your food. And then again, we also like what's emotion, what's reward is a little bit ambiguous, but things that are positive outcomes, you'd want to know how to make those happen again. And remembering more about what was happening in that kind of context is helpful to make those kind of, have your ability to control the situation a bit and see which ones you want to happen again and which ones you might want to avoid by trying, in a sense, like reinstating that context of being there at that time of day and at the same place and hoping to either, yeah, avoid bad things or have the good things come again. So it definitely is kind of evolutionarily helpful. And then that's kind of lends itself to why there's also been a lot of research across different species and not just with people, to kind of focus on those in a more evolutionary setting and survival. And then showing that level of generality, whereas let's say with humans, we can show words, not so useful for other species, but some cues are more general and can be used as well.
All right. That makes a lot of sense. I mean, from an evolutionary standpoint, they're here to serve us, but I believe they have an ugly side, especially when it comes to maybe PTSD. So have you looked into, well, the role of emotional memory in PTSD? Does it offer anything other than the trauma itself?
Well, I guess in a sense, I guess PTSD is it's built on an adaptive type of behavior, but being occurring in a maladaptive setting.
All right.
So one way of framing kind of what PTSD is that emotional memories that happen, in some sense, were relevant and restored, are coming up and being retrieved unintentionally in a setting where they're not helpful. So at a time, they were helpful in terms of focusing on survival and making out to the, like, living on to the future. But then if you're not in a setting where you're kind of need to worry about survival and worry about kind of being that level of vigilant and stressed, that's becoming more chronic and not just for the instance where it's, again, made to be beneficial, then that ends up being a problem because it's distracting someone. And like, it's distracting is obviously an understatement, but it's impairing someone from the kind of living life happily because there's these memories that are coming back in a way that isn't helping. If they were, like, if the person was, let's say, in a kind of a war zone or a setting where those kind of having that level of vigilance was still relevant, then we probably wouldn't call it kind of a PTSD. It would be more actually kind of beneficial to survival. But if it's happening in what's otherwise kind of a safe place after that incident's all done, then it's not good. So it's basically something that's kind of evolved to be adaptive and served its purpose in the sense of you're still there. The memories can still come to mind, but obviously is generalizing into a period that's not great anymore.
Yeah, it's just maladaptive way of using emotional memory, isn't it?
Right.
Unfortunately.
So it's doing its purpose, but almost too well.
Too well. Yeah, I guess so. I shouldn't be laughing here. I mean, looking at emotional memory, you mentioned that something being characterized as negative kind of makes it more salient. Are there any other characteristics that make a memory stand out?
So, again, positive is good, too. It's just in an experimental setting, it's a little bit more individual variability.
Yeah.
And then as we were kind of alluding to, like, if something's rewarding, that's, or it's more punishing. Like, if we have people see pictures on the computer screen and give them shocks, they'll remember when they got the shock. Like, it doesn't, like, it's obviously, I guess, more also getting into, like, fear conditioning in some sense. But one of the, I guess, thing that I've been interested in is how similar emotion and reward are, even though they're kind of cast as different subfields of memory research, procedurally there's a lot of overlap.
Okay.
And then, as we were kind of talking about earlier, about self-relevance, like, if someone's important to you or if someone's calling out your name or something that is more relevant to your kind of self and identity, then those are things that are also remembered better than things that are kind of, again, more mundane otherwise. So there's a lot of attributes that can kind of make something be better remembered and more salient across these kind of various of dimensions. And then at least some of the work that I've been doing is trying to kind of propose a kind of common domain general motivational theory that bridges across these, like, not to say that there's no difference between them, but that there's a lot more overlap in these different types of kind of salience and kind of survival relevant aspects to them, rather than treating them too much kind of compartmentalized in the literature as just separate topics that some people study this, some people study that, but they don't talk to each other, trying to bring that together and find more of a common thread. But again, there's still some nuance in how they're different there too.
And so far, would we be able to touch base? How far have you come with that work?
So I guess it's more theoretical than an experiment kind of demonstrating it.
All right.
But again, for instance, showing that in the reward literature, if you give someone a shock, and in the emotion literature, if you do fear conditioning, those aren't all that different of a thing. Like, you could take the same procedure and methods,
eventually
and
same outcome,
cast it in the other framework, and publish it as that type of paper, no one would bat an eye. You just use different terms. But the people studying emotion, the people studying reward effects on memory, there is increasingly kind of more overlap between those two. Yeah. But let's say a decade ago, 20 years ago, those were more distinct kind of topics within the memory literature. Yeah. And now myself and others are kind of bringing those together, but then also trying to be a little bit more overarching. And again, things like self-relevance. And I guess some work that I've also done is on objects and kind of motor interaction properties. So like some things that you can easily functionally use versus those that you can more just volumetrically like pick up and throw, like say a vase or a brick, can't really use them too much. Like a vase, you put flowers in it, but you can't use it like as a tool.
Yeah.
Versus things that are more tools or musical instruments or things that you can use, those tend to be remembered better because they have this affordances and ability to kind of be used functionally, and kind of wrapping that all in the same overall literature as emotion and reward and other types of kind of motivation factors. And then again, more of, again, theoretically kind of discussing where these are similar, where these are different, what we can draw from animal literature versus human brain imaging literature, and try and integrate across those and find kind of commonalities and not just be like, these are different things and ignoring the rest.
All right. I mean, before ending this episode, since we've narrowed it down to your work, I just wanted to ask,
sure,
on a personal note, would you be able to tell us why is that you decided to invest, you know, all your time and energy into this topic of research?
Sure.
What drove you to do that?
Initially as an undergrad, I just wanted to study something about brain and behavior. How does this biological like lump of tissue somehow relate to and kind of, again, how it really works is a whole complicated thing, but like relate to our ability to behave and act and be a person and like have a consciousness and all of that.
Yeah.
So I contacted a few researchers at the university I was at for my undergrad studies.
Yeah.
And one of them who does memory research kind of gave me opportunity to work in his research lab.
Right.
And the first study that I did looked at word imageability and word frequency.
Mm-hmm.
So if a word represents something that you can make a mental image of, like let's say apple or table, versus things that are more abstract, like the word justice.
Yeah.
How does that affect memory? And also word frequency, or words that are more common are generally remembered better than words that are kind of less frequently used.
Obviously.
And then I did some of that work,
yeah,
and that was ended up being my first published paper. And then from that and talking to other people in the department, then the idea was to kind of use, in a sense, the same experimental procedure, but look at emotion and see how that related to this. All this was about memory for item properties and our ability to make associations. And then basically use the same kind of structure of the study and look at emotion. And then with some of this kind of idea of individual variability and how your own experiences prior to the study can influence performance, then I started looking at reward, where I would take stimuli that were kind of otherwise all neutral and give them a reward history in a kind of decision-making task. And then from that kind of also branch more into decision-making and gambling kind of literature and how that relates to memory. So the initial thing really was to study memory more in a kind of basic fundamental science way.
Yeah.
And it kind of came up about like, why does this matter? Like, who cares that you remember this better than that? And from that, getting a little bit more into what's more important and what's kind of more relevant to you. And then that ended up being through emotion, through reward, through self-relevance, through motor processing, and all of those are kind of different ways to make something more kind of motivationally relevant. And then in other work, trying to figure out memory strategies, like we talked about retrieval practice.
Yeah.
But there's other ways as well that you can just remember things otherwise. So it started from doing basic science research and then people asking me, like, who cares? And then being still basic science research, but a little bit more interested in the things that do affect our day-to-day kind of life and more about I guess the kind of colloquial way that I describe it is memory for important things. Yeah. Like, what does it mean to be important gets more complicated and scientific again, mm. but at least on a kind of lay level, things that are important. How do you remember those better than less important things?
Yeah.
And then that keeps you busy.
I mean, that's excellent advice for early researchers. It's just get your foot in the door at any... at any, you know, research position at a, you know, investing a topic that you find relevantly interesting, and then narrow it down until someone tells yes. you that they care enough to to fund it.
Yeah, it's definitely better to start kind of broad, or at least be open to kind of whichever opportunities arise, and then narrow later.
Yeah.
Because sometimes there are people that approach me that have a very specific thing in mind, and it's like, well, it's not really what I want to study, so... I guess good luck. But if they're more open to kind of just getting fundamental skills,
yeah.
like the work that I'm doing now has shifted a bit over time from, let's say, where I started.
Yeah.
So like one of the kind of current projects I'm starting to work on is how aromas related to wine end up affecting memory.
Whoa.
So a lot of people look at pictures and sounds because those are the easiest things to present as stimuli.
Obviously.
But there are, what about scents? Like things like basically the kind of little containers that have smells in them.
Yeah.
And then looking at how well people can identify and learn to identify those smells.
Mm.
And then which smells, and there's kind of aroma kits that are designed for wine sommelier. So I bought those and I'm using that as part of the stimuli for studies.
I am looking forward to seeing the outcomes on that experiment.
I think it's good to kind of have a big picture and let things meander a bit.
Of course. Start off as a generalist. Kind of
as well known for a topic, but yeah. I find also an important part of it.
So start off as a generalist and then become a specialist as you go down.
Yes. And even then, like, as you learn more of literature, then you can make a more informed decision of what kind of to specialize in than what you might think from a more naive perspective of this is interesting, but then not be sure where to go.
Mm.
So like, yeah, start somewhere, get in contact with a researcher, and then they'll suggest readings and whatnot, and kind of they'll have a plan of, generally experienced researchers have more ideas than they have time to do, where, and they are things that are publishable, at least in principle.
That's
so
like,
they can get you a heading, and then you start with something kind of safe.
Yeah.
And then learn your own kind of and discuss that, obviously, not just too much on your own, as you kind of can develop experience and then figure out your own niche and, or at least project wise, what's interesting to you as you progress.
Oh, wow. Okay. I mean, yeah. You've given us more advice. I think that I need to devote an entire episode advice for early researchers.
So maybe one thing I'll end on then that maybe could prompt the next one. Is I have a book coming out in about a month or so.
That's amazing.
I don't know when this will go online.
That's amazing.
Where I've interviewed people who did PhDs in psychology and neuroscience.
Yeah.
About some in academia, some not in academia.
Okay.
And then talking about them about how they're kind of like what their PhD was in, how they've progressed from that into, in a sense, more kind of stable job and where they are now, and then advice that they have for people finishing a PhD about careers and stuff.
Oh, wow. So okay. I wouldn't be able to, would I be able to maybe, no. All right. We're either going to have to publish your episode later on or I'm just going to give a sneak peek of the book.
I have a copy of it. It's all done. It's just not printed yet.
Ah.
So I can give you a sneak peek, but yeah.
A sneak peek it is.
It'll be out in stores shortly, I guess. This is what it looks like. I don't know if I think that's just for us
academia,
for now.
The world beyond. That's honestly, that's a great idea, especially for someone like me who just started off, and for all my other colleagues, we would really benefit off something like this. You know,
so
learn
the idea
some other
like
people's
from
trial and errors.
Perspective was, I guess I did look into non-academic careers when I was a postdoc and looking into jobs, and then otherwise it's just. As a supervisor now, like I have a few PhD students that are finishing up. In some of the lab meetings, we discuss kind of professional development and kind of career stuff and things beyond just specific projects.
Mm.
And then how to give advice and like how to position a student best for career stuff, both academic and non-academic, because they're like, we should be to the degree that I can support that. And part of that's knowing people in non-academic jobs,